Let's get into it. Hebrews chapter 2. And here, if the theme is Jesus is a better deliverer, last week we said Jesus is better than the angels, of course. And here we are going to see something now that we will run through in the next couple of weeks. When we were actually educated about this, all those of us that are teachers actually go to a class to learn how to teach the course. And the person that was teaching it was Dr. Steve Smith, who's kind of the vice president over there at Southwestern Baptist Seminary. And he started by saying, I just want to say one thing about the book of Hebrews. It's an incredibly difficult book of the Bible to teach. That was his starter, so that was right off the bat something. But he used an illustration during the presentation that he helped us learn how to teach, and that is the idea. You know what a toggle switch is? He says, in a sense, the writer of Hebrew toggles between teaching about the gospel, which we saw last week, and then warning passages. And there are five of them, and we're going to run into one very quickly here in the first part of chapter 2. These warning passages sometimes have been terribly misinterpreted. I'm going to take one of those on today. And of course, we'll have four others as we go through this series. And of course, we can see that the focus here is the writer of Hebrews, which many of us believe is perhaps Luke, is warning about the fact that some of the readers that are receiving this letter are starting to drift spiritually. And so he warns them against spiritual drift. Let's look at our passage here. First of all, we'll look at the first four verses, which is part of the warning passage, and begins by, "Therefore we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. For since the message declared by angels proved to be reliable, and every transgression or disobedience received a just retribution, how shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? It was declared at first by the Lord, and it was attested to us by those who heard, while God also bore witness by signs and wonders and various miracles and by gifts of the Holy Spirit distributed according to his will." And this is one of those warning passages, not to neglect a great salvation. And here he says, basically, pay close attention. They need to pay closer attention to the gospel. And basically, it is the idea that the gospel is sort of your anchor point in the ocean. And if you're not anchored to it, then you can kind of just drift away. And I've had a chance over the last few months to hear what some of you do when you go to the beach. Now, what I understand is some of you go to the beach and you sit, you prop a book up, and you read the whole time. But I think some of us, when we've gone to the beach, have also recognized that we will maybe get out on a raft, and that raft will begin to float. And if you're not really paying attention, one of the things you find very quickly is that you look up, and where you were was over here. You kind of just drift in the ocean. And so I think it's kind of interesting to remind us that just as you can be on a raft on the ocean and sort of drift away, or heaven forbid if any of you ever got caught in a riptide, you can find yourself very far away from where you intended to be. Well, the illustration, that's why I put a boat up there, is the same thing. There is a real tendency, I think, in the Christian life, if you're a mature Christian, and you've been a Christian for some time, for you to drift. And we have a lot of mature Christians in here, and so that may be a greater danger. You might remember when you first became a Christian, you're so excited, and you're reading the Bible all the time. And I was with somebody recently, and he said, when I first read the Bible, you know, I went to a Bible study, and after the Bible study, they turned on the TV set, and I was just so incensed. I thought we should just be reading our Bibles 24/7. Well, you know how it gets as you become more of a mature Christian. Sometimes there's a real easy tendency to drift. And as you can see what I put on the screen here, if it was possible for a person to drift spiritually in the first century, with a very small number of distractions, how easy is it now to drift in the 21st century where we are assaulted by distractions? Are you with me? So if it was true to believers in the first century, it's something to pay attention to in this century is all. And here, again, I love how he says it. We should not neglect what? A great salvation. You know, there is a sense also part of the spiritual drift is sometimes we can think of, well, you know, when you first became saved, you just realized what God had done in your life. But after a while, it is easier sometimes to take that for granted. And here he's reminding him once again, don't take for granted such a great salvation that you enjoy. And then he takes him back to the message declared by the angels. And that's really a reference back to the Old Testament. And if you're taking some notes, I know some of you like to take notes on that handout there, you might put down Galatians 3, verse 19, because this just reminds us again of how the gospel was delivered, and it reflects back on the Old Testament as well. Now, here's something else. Who is the audience receiving this? Well, by and large, they're Jewish believers. They grew up as Jews, and now they have become Christians, and now they're maturing in their faith. And so he is using a great illustration, because they were familiar as Jews with the consequences of disobeying the Old Testament law. And here, again, the argument is sort of made that if there were consequences, if there were spiritual consequences to disobeying the Old Testament law, how much more are there consequences to neglecting the gospel? Do you see the point? It's not minimizing the Old Testament. It's just saying that the gospel is even more important than the Old Testament. So if there was a danger in neglecting the Old Testament, how much more neglecting the New Testament gospel? And so that's kind of the argument is being made there as well. Now, here's where you get some miscommunication. There are individuals sometimes that when they look at one of these warning passages, if they take them out of context, and if you take a Bible verse out of context, it becomes a pretext for, you know what, any kind of heresy or anything like that. Some Christians believe that this particular passage is really a warning to non-Christians who fail to accept Jesus and the consequences. But I would say that here, look at the word. The word there is neglect, not reject. Reject would be what a non-believer. I hear the gospel and I reject it. Neglect is where you had something but you don't take care of it. If we were to go and look at all of our lawns today after the rain, you know, maybe some have been neglected because we couldn't mow it. At least that's the excuse I'm using today. Anyway, that's been at least the excuse I used yesterday. Can't mow the lawn because it's raining, okay? So, you know, you might see it's neglect. Or I can look inside some of our houses and maybe we neglect it. But the idea is at one point it had order. And I think the word neglect illustrates only so well that we're talking about believers here. We're not talking about somebody who rejects salvation. But of course, with neglect comes some real consequences, because after all, we are seeing that it's even more disturbing, because this is not something that was revealed by the prophets or by the angels. Remember last week, we talked about the fact that Jesus is better than the prophets, Jesus is better than the angels. So if we neglect what Jesus has delivered, once again, we see how great a salvation it is. And so again, it's just a reminder, which we'll come back to in our application point, that we need to really perhaps focus more than ever on spiritual drift in our lives. That may be more of a danger in, say, the examine class, where many of you have been Christians for many years, perhaps many decades, than it would be in a new believer's class. Does that make sense? And so in some respects, that is the case. So, you know, again, we might ask ourselves, you know, how many Christians do you know that really give sustained attention to their salvation? You know, they love what God has done in their life. They think about their salvation. They meditate upon it. They marvel at this great salvation they have. If I can go from preaching to meddling, do you live that way? You know, does that describe where you are in your Christian walk? And this is the question that is asked of all of us by the writer of Hebrews. In this world of distractions, I would argue that it is great danger, perhaps the greater danger of us to spiritually drift. You know that if an atheist came up to you today and challenged your faith, you might have a few doubts or some questions and things like that, but you walk away and it probably wouldn't change you at all. You could probably see some program on television tonight that challenges the authority of the Bible, and you might go, I wonder what Josh McDowell has to say about that. I wonder what Kirby has to say about that. I wonder what, you know. By the way, Sean McDowell's going to be in my studio tomorrow, in case any of you ever like to meet Sean McDowell. But the bottom line is, you know, you might go, oh, whatever, and it wouldn't change you. Satan's not going to just turn you like a light switch from a Christian into a non-Christian. But he might be able to seduce you into drifting away from the Christian faith. And so I think that's perhaps one passage here, one of the warning passages we'll look at over the next couple of weeks that maybe is most applicable to those of us in the class. Well, then finally, we also see something else. And that is, we begin to see something about the various stages of witness. You see that in the handout. In the first stage we see is God. God, verse 3, says it was declared by the Lord that he is God the Father. So we see, first of all, the first witness is God himself. The second is Christ, because he is what? The mediator, the go-between God and man. Don't you like what Pastor Graham said today when the Pope's coming? I got a kick out of that, you know. He never misses an opportunity to teach us a little bit. Then finally, attested by those who heard, that's the apostles. And then finally, God himself, verse 4, who bore witness by signs and wonders. And this is something else that I think gives us a very firm foundation, because these witnesses give a firm foundation for our faith. You know, you might have somebody say, you know, God told me something. You go, well, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. You might have somebody that says, well, you know, God miraculously healed me. You go, well, maybe God healed you and maybe you just went in remission. But you know, if you line all these up, you know, God has revealed, then Jesus has taught, then you begin to see the apostles give a testimony, and then finally miracles and wonders and signs. Do you see how it kind of adds up? It's one of the reasons why that when Norm Geisler and Frank Turek, by the way, Frank Turek was just speaking at University of Texas Dallas this week, they wrote a book called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Because when you add up all of the evidences, all of the stages of witness, you're really working against tremendous odds if you are an atheist or an agnostic. And so this collection of these four different stages of witnesses, I think, really do confirm the gospel. And one of the reasons why they could write a book called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. We also learn a little bit about the three tenses of salvation. You know, we see I was saved. Justification is I was saved. That's what happened in the past. Then sanctification, I'm being saved. I'm in the process of growing in my faith and becoming more Christ-like. And then finally, glorification, I will be saved completely and in perfection. And so again, the key question there is, what are we doing to prevent drift? Some very significant issues that we can put on the table. Well, let's, if we can, continue on here, and we'll start in verse 5, looking at some other aspects of this as well. Now it was to the angels that God subjected the world to come, of which we are speaking. It has been testified somewhere. What is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you care for him? You made him for a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor, putting everything in subjection under his feet. Now, in putting everything in subjection to him, he left nothing outside of his control. At present, we do not see everything in subjection to him, but we see him for a little while, was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. And so once again here we see that Jesus accomplished the victory. The writer of Hebrews explains the role of Jesus in salvation because, in a sense, as we saw last time, Jesus is better than the angels, and in a sense, salvation itself is, well, as much. We also see here it uses this phrase, the world to come, and this is really talking about the fact that many of these things that the writer of Hebrews is talking about are partially fulfilled now, will be completely fulfilled later on. We'll see this when he talks about this idea of subjection. And I think it's important to recognize he's not necessarily trying to downgrade the angels, because the angels are very important, but he's trying to explain the different roles that we have. And then immediately quotes from Psalm 8. Remember that? What is God that a man is mindful of him? And we see that. And it talks about the fact that we have dominion over the world, that he has put everything in subjection to him. And we see this in Genesis 1, verses 26 and 27. Going to be talking about that in the next couple of weeks in our creation presentations right here with the Institute for Creation Research, that in some respects, and if you don't understand creation, you don't understand the idea of dominion. If you don't understand Genesis, you really don't understand the rest of the Bible. So please try to mark your calendars for the next couple of weeks to come in here on a Wednesday night and learn from some of these individuals. But then it talks about the fact that Jesus became man. You made him a little lower for a while than the angels. That's the idea of the incarnation. Then it talks about Jesus suffered and died, and it says for all mankind, that he might taste death for everyone. And then finally, Jesus was crowned with glory and honor because of his sacrifice, because of his suffering of death. And so God gave this great salvation to us, not the angels. We will certainly find out as Pastor Graham's book on angels come out, one of the things that angels tend to wonder about is us. The angels look down at us and they wonder about all of this. That we are given free will, that God has brought his salvation to us. It's a great salvation. But then, of course, this gets back to this issue of dominion, because it asks the question, who then rules the world? Because Psalm 8 reminds us that we are significant, and God has appointed us to rule over his creation, putting everything in subjection under his feet. But as soon as we see the writer of Hebrews point out, all things are not subjected to man right now, but we can see what they might mean. Because ever since the fall, the Garden of Eden, we've seen how God has allowed us to use technology to improve various aspects of this fallen world. And with this technology, we can control the creation. That is, you can see that right now we can control the creation. It may be warm outside, but it's nice and cool inside. We are able to travel much faster than human beings would have ever imagined, on cars and planes and things like that. So in some respects, technology has allowed us to have very significant dominion over this planet. If there's a mountain in our way, we can actually bring out road graders and plow it out and flatten it out. If we want to do all sorts of things in the environment, improve the genetic fitness of various creatures, we're able to breed those. So we've been able to use a lot of technology to have, if you will, a little bit of a glimmer of what it would be like when everything is in subjection to us. But at the same time, there are some things we can't control. Like a rain at a picnic, for example, you know, or a windstorm at a wedding, or whatever it might be. We can't control everything, but it is, I think, pointing to a day in which we can and will have complete control, that everything will ultimately be in subjection to us because we will co-reign with Jesus Christ. That's an incredible kind of claim that is found here in the Scriptures. So let's, if we can, talk about maybe some of the application in that regard. The first is to recognize the readers of this. They were going through a great deal of persecution. They were facing some of those trials that we just talked about and temptations that sometimes we'll get into. And this was a bold prediction that even though you are facing persecution right now, and after Pastor Graham's message this morning, you may be facing a trial right now. You may not, as he said, be asking why, but you certainly might be asking how long. This was an attempt to at least remind them that there will be a time in which everything will be in subjection. You will be subjected to a fallen world, but instead, everything will be in subjection to you. That's an incredible claim, and it's certainly just an illustration of what we are looking forward to. Well, then finally, let's finish off this passage here by looking at Jesus becoming a man. And what does the incarnation perhaps answer in terms of some of the questions we might have? We see in verse 10, "For it was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. For he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one source. That is why he is not ashamed to call them brothers, saying, 'I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will sing your praise.' And again, 'I will put my trust in him.' And again, 'Behold, I and the children God has given me.' Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that though death might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver those who, though fear of death, were subject to lifelong slavery. For surely it is not angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. Therefore, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted." And this, again, may have been some of the teaching that we now have, are privy to, because there are some that believe that what you have here is what was actually taught by Jesus after his resurrection, before his ascension. And Luke may have been actually taking down these notes. And here it's, first of all, a reminder that Jesus is the founder of salvation. Now, the Greek word probably could easily be translated author, or a lot of them will use the word in the English translation, you may have one of those, that calls him the captain of our salvation. It's a Greek word that is actually used to describe somebody who is the founder of a city, or an individual that is a founder of a family line. And so in a sense, it's talking about Jesus as kind of like the trailblazer. He's the initiator. He's the one that's bringing some of this about. And so that certainly is an aspect of what is happening there. It also says that Jesus was one of us and connects with us on the human level. Because not only is he the captain, but he's also a fellow traveler. He's also the creator. He's also the sustainer of life. And so we can now begin to see his connection to us. And now the writer of Hebrews quotes from three different Old Testament passages. The first one we see in Psalm 22, where it says, Jesus calls us brother. That's kind of intriguing. Don't you love that? I mean, we're referred to as brothers of Jesus. Then we see a second quote, and I will put my trust in him. We looked at that last time, talked about that, in God we trust. Ever heard that phrase? It's on our money. It's right above the speaker in the House of Representatives. It comes from Isaiah 8, and here we put our trust in him. And then finally, the next verse in Isaiah 8, verse 18, it links us and refers to us as children of God. So again, we can see that even though he was the captain, he is the founder, he is the initiator, he's also a fellow traveler, and we can call Christ our brother. And so there's some really powerful things that we learn from in that regard as well. I'm having a little trouble with my controller today, as you probably figured out. Let's go on to verse 14 and 15. Jesus conquered death through death. It talks about the fact that he became man to die. And here is one of the teachings about Satan. One of the things that we see is that Satan, and we see this in other passages in the New Testament, holds the non-believer captive in slavery, in bondage to death. Just think about what it would be like if you did not have Jesus Christ. Just think for a second like an unbeliever, and you see death around you, or you maybe go to a funeral and a good friend of yours died. What are you thinking? You know, is this it? Is that all there is? And Satan, apparently, according to what is written in a number of passages in the New Testament, holds the unbeliever in bondage, in slavery, because of a fear of death. And here, this is a reminder that even though Satan holds them in slavery and in bondage, we are no longer subjected to that slavery because we've been freed from that bondage because we have hope for everlasting life. We also see that he then now is also our helper. Not only does he free us from that bondage, but he also helps us as well. The idea that Satan is now unarmed, he no longer has control over you. Satan is impotent around you. He no longer has power over you because of that. And so we can enjoy a victory because of the cross and what Jesus did on the cross for us. And he then can be a help for us. It's not just a one-time, Jesus saved me, but he's also going to be your helper in other ways. We see this in verse 17. Look at this. Therefore, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become merciful and a faithful high priest in his service. And it goes on to say that he will help us when we are tempted. So he helps us resist temptation because he suffered when tempted and is able to help us. We'll see later on that we don't just certainly worship a great high priest who has no understanding of what we've been through. The good news is that when we face temptation, we can honestly know that Jesus faced that same temptation. Isn't that amazing? Because one of the arguments I get sometimes from people that have fallen into sin is, well, you have no idea what my life is like. You have no idea the pressures I faced in my business. You don't know what it's like to be married to that man or to married to that woman. You have no idea what it was like to go through the financial reversals I went through. You have no idea what it was like to have dealt with this cancer. I can sometimes say, no, I don't. Jesus does. You have no idea of the trials and tribulations, but Jesus does. Because we don't worship just a great high priest who has no understanding of your trials or your temptations, but he is a fellow traveler. He's a helper still. He is poised to help us with our trials and temptations. My latest book has a chapter in there, and it's called, interestingly enough, Life is a Test. There's always going to be a test. There's always going to be a trial. There's always going to be a temptation. And even though I said it in my book, I'll give credit to Jack Graham who said it last week. If you're going through a trial, either you have just finished a trial, you're in the midst of the trial, or you're going to go into a trial, right? Okay, so again, we have to recognize that trials and temptations are part of life. Life is a test. And in James and in Hebrews, there's a reminder that we still have someone who is a fellow traveler, who has actually walked the same road, experienced the same kind of trials and tribulations and temptations, and is a better helper because he understands our humanity. Isn't that incredible? Well, again, let's talk about our application before we go into our final issue. If you're taking some notes, at least two things I take out of this chapter, and there are many others we can. But the first is that the writer is warning us of a spiritual drift. We see that in the first four verses. The question I would certainly give you as a semi-homework assignment, we give assignments, but we don't test on them. I was in a class yesterday where they were giving us a lot of information. At one point, the teacher said, well, we're not going to test you on this. And I could see this kind of, good. Because, you know, I've been in a few of those where you have to take a test, you know, to qualify for this, that, or the other. But again, I'll give you an assignment. There's not going to be a test on it. We're not going to grade on it. But that is, what are you doing to prevent spiritual drift? How does your quiet time look? How does your prayer life look? Where do you spend time in God's Word? You know, what are you doing to prevent the spiritual drift, which I think is perhaps a greater problem for, say, the examine class than maybe the new believers class here at Prestonwood. And so what are you doing to prevent spiritual drift? Because what he says is, do not neglect such a great salvation that we enjoy. What are you doing to make sure that you just sort of drift away? Kind of like on that inner tube, and all of a sudden you look up and where I want to be is over here, and if I don't turn this around pretty soon, I'm half my way to Cozumel, which is where we're going to go, I guess, in January. So that's the first one. The second one is, Jesus can help us through our trials and temptations. We see this in verses 10 through 18. Well, the question I would ask for you is, do you call on him when you're facing trials or temptations? It's a good question to ask. You know, I've had some individuals, Christians, that travel for business, and they say, you know, you walk into a hotel, you walk into a hotel room, you're there by yourself, there's that television, there's all sorts of temptations. It's like, nobody would know, you know. Are you calling upon the Lord when that takes place? Are you calling upon the Lord when you're in the midst of a trial, when all of a sudden the diagnosis isn't what you expected? And the question again is, do you call on him then to help you with those trials or those temptations? And again, I'm repeating many of the things that Pastor Graham has shared just in the last couple of days and weeks as we were going through simultaneously James and Hebrews. It's kind of wonderful that we're doing that. So that's our application point. But now, for just a minute, I thought we'd get into some of the Ask Kirby questions before we all head off to Baker Brothers for lunch. Everybody ready? One of the questions was, as you might remember, EJ stood up here a couple weeks ago and he said, okay, I got this paper clipping here, and it talks about the fact that the Ten Commandments monument in Oklahoma was supposed to be ripped down in the ACLU. And if you've not seen it, that's what the monument looks like. If you go to Oklahoma City right now, the monument is still there, but the idea is it's supposed to be torn down. Okay, Kirby, what are you supposed to say about that? That's what EJ wanted to talk about. Well, there are a couple of issues that you need to understand. And the first of this is that, yes, the state Supreme Court in Oklahoma ruled that the state must remove the Ten Commandments monument. Now, why did this case go to the court? Well, it turns out that after they had posted the Ten Commandments back in 2012, the Satanic Temple said, well, if you can post the Ten Commandments, then we want to post, and there's a picture of it, the Baphomet sculpture on the state capitol. The reason I have a picture of it is they just now took this particular bronze sculpture to Detroit. And apparently, I guess they want to now put it in Michigan, on the Capitol, or in Detroit, or at the city council, or something like that. Isn't that the ugliest and scariest looking thing you've ever seen in your life? Okay, so the argument is, well, if you get to put the Ten Commandments up, then we get to put something else up. Then the evolutionists got in there and they said, we want to put up the Flying Spaghetti Monster monument. And so it just sort of got out of hand real quickly. So at this point then, that's when there was a kind of a sense of, well, where do we go with that? And the ACLU said, okay, we're going to jump in and we're going to file a lawsuit. Well, they brought the suit in federal court, but as you're going to see in just a minute, that didn't work very well, so then they brought the suit to the state court. The reason it didn't work when they brought it to the federal court is the United States Supreme Court ruled a number of years ago that the Ten Commandments monument, and this is a picture of it in this Texas Capitol, is constitutional. Remember that case? And so they'd already ruled in federal court that a Ten Commandments monument can be legal in a state capitol. So there was no chance that they were going to win that particular case. Here's the difference. Oklahoma is one of those interesting states where, although the state is really conservative, people haven't really paid attention to the individuals that have been elected to the state Supreme Court. And so the Oklahoma State Supreme Court is pretty liberal, with a capital L, by the way. Now, that, I think, also brings an application point. You know, when you're going to vote next year, even if you have some voting that might take place this November, but especially the big votes are going to take place next year, and certainly in the off-year elections in the state, you know, you look down and say, okay, I know who the president is, I might know who the senators are, I know my member of Congress, I don't know who any of these state Supreme Court justices are, so I'll just, you know, click the ones that are incumbents, or I won't vote at all. And they, I think in the state of Oklahoma, are starting to say, I think we need to pay attention a little bit more who's on the state Supreme Court. So, interestingly enough, the very liberal state Supreme Court then said, well, we're not going to look at the U.S. Constitution. We're not going to look at how the federal courts ruled. We're going to look at the state Constitution. We're going, well, the state Constitution's still, you know, pretty conservative and pretty open to religious liberty, but it turns out that there is a particular amendment that was added to the Constitution, which is related to the Blaine Amendments. Now, remember when you took a civics class, maybe you learned about the Blaine Amendments? You're going, yeah, but it's been a long time. What are the Blaine Amendments? It turns out that in the 19th century, there was a real concern about whether or not federal dollars or even state dollars could go to private schools. This was motivated in large part by Protestants who were fearful of these parochial schools. And so one of the people that spoke out against this was President Ulysses S. Grant, that said federal money should never go to religious education. Okay. So James Blaine actually proposed an amendment that almost became an amendment in the Constitution that was passed by a couple of states that actually said that no federal monies could ever go to religious education. So one of those particular kind of amendments is in the Oklahoma Constitution. So with the most bizarre kind of twisted kind of argument saying that no money can go to religious education, they applied it to no money or any funds could go to have a Ten Commandments monument. So there is how we got to this point. Now, would you like me to tell you the rest of the story? Pretty good story. Turns out that the current plan right now, and I worked with Kelly Shackelford at Liberty Institute, said what they're going to do is they're going to move the monument across the street. People don't realize that across the street, that's private land. So they're just going to move the monument across the street. Most people don't even realize that's not government property. Then, as soon as the Oklahoma legislature can meet, they're going to pass legislation to invalidate Oklahoma's version of the Blaine Amendment. And then they're going to take and move the monument right back. So I told you the plan before it happened, so when it happens, you can all laugh, right? So anyway, EJ, thank you for bringing that up. But just before we run out of time, I think it's a good example of even this loss, I think, is eventually going to become a victory. Because number one, there's two lessons. Lesson number one, pay attention to who you vote for the state Supreme Court. Number two, Look back, I would say to any legislators, I don't think we have anybody in the Texas legislature here today, but we sometimes do, go and make sure that there's not some lingering law from the 19th century there that could be misinterpreted. I mean, we still have some laws in the books that say that before you go through an intersection, you have to honk your horn, you know, and so that you don't run into horses and things like that. We have some of these old laws that are still on the books out there. Be careful of that. But I wanted you to show that even though this looks like a defeat, I think it'll be a victory. But let's, if we can, for just a minute, talk about just some of the victories that have come down just recently, a lot of these through Liberty Institute and some others. And the first one is the Ten Commandments case. The fact is that the ACLU couldn't even file this case on federal court with anybody taking it seriously. I think they tried to file it, but it wasn't going to go anywhere because we have Von Orden versus Perry. That was, of course, Governor Rick Perry that established that a Ten Commandments monument in Austin is constitutional. Then we have all sorts of cross cases. These have come primarily through Liberty Institute. You have the Mojave Memorial Cross. There was a cross out there in the Mojave Desert, and one individual got upset about it, and so they actually took it and it went all the way to the Supreme Court before they did have to cover the cross over with it, and then the cross was stolen, and they found it and put it back up there. But eventually the Supreme Court ruled that the cross was constitutional. But that didn't resolve it because we had another cross case. That's out of San Diego. That's the Mount Soledad Veterans Cross. And that one eventually was resolved because they transferred ownership to the Mount Soledad Veterans Memorial Association. So that cross, if you ever go to San Diego, you can go and see it's right there as well. You have the various military cases, and the one that we just announced on Friday had to do with Chaplain Wes Motter. He has been, first he was a Marine, and now he's a chaplain in the U.S. Navy. And there were some that were setting him up. They came to him and asked him what his stance was on homosexuality. And he gave a biblical answer and then got in trouble for giving a biblical answer for what the Bible has to say about homosexuality. And so then his commanding officer wanted to discipline him and actually run him out of the Navy and put all sorts of negative recommendations in his file. There's even was some talk about a court-martial, but that wasn't going to be the case. But this was a big case, not just for him, for any other chaplain. Because it's a good question. Could a chaplain actually use biblical arguments to explain what the Bible has to say? You know, and of course this has been a big issue. And 2 weeks ago, Kelly Shackelford was around when they were wondering if this case was going to be appealed. Well, it was never appealed because the higher commanding officer simply said, enough is enough. They actually removed everything that had been done against him. The man that actually caused him problems, he has been encouraged to seek employment elsewhere, and Chaplain Motter has a clean bill of health, has actually was given an opportunity to pick any assignment he wants, so he had that assignment, and this is, I think, a win again for every chaplain in the military. You're starting to see a pattern here. You may not have heard about all these in Fox News, but I wanted you to know that there are lots of victories right now. A couple having to do with churches. You had a case where they were going to actually close down Opulent Springs, which is a church in Mississippi, because they wanted to use eminent domain to bring it down. Liberty Institute won on that case, so they used that precedent to now save a church in Houston. There are a couple of African-American churches in Houston that are going through this right now. One of those is Missionary Baptist Church. What has happened is that there are places in Houston where the police don't even like to go because it's such a dangerous community. Well, these churches over time have become salt and light, and they've changed the community. They have done a lot by leading people to the Lord and having outreaches and other things that the community's gotten better. So then the city of Houston said, oh, well, this is nice land. We're going to just kick you off of it so we can build profit-making entities. Well, in this particular case, a judge once again ruled in favor of the church over the various government agencies that wanted to kick them out. And I thought that was kind of interesting. And then one last one, you see these senior centers. So you might remember in Balch Springs a couple of years ago, this was one where Liberty Institute, where they were telling them at the Balch Springs Senior Center that they could not actually have a prayer and Bible study time at the Senior Center Because after all, they're government funds. They've got to be separation of church and state. And so you might remember that you had all these veterans that were at the senior center marching out there. And remember, they interviewed one veteran on Channel 8. And he said, you know, I didn't fight in World War II to go pray in a corner here, you know. And then there was one woman that they interviewed, and she said, I want to show you something. And so the camera comes over here, and she pops open the trunk of the car, and she says, veterans and old grandmas for religious liberty. And so that one made it on Channel 8 as well. Well, anyway, they won that case. Well, there was one this just last week in San Antonio at the senior center where they'd been doing needlepoint. But after they were doing needlepoint, they began to have a prayer and Bible study. And 16 of the 18 women became Christians. Well, again, they said, we can't do that because, after all, you know, that's separation of church and state. But again, they won that case as well. The point I'm making is that this has been really good news over the last couple of weeks for religious liberty. And even when you think we lose, like in the case of Oklahoma City, to stick around long enough, I think you're going to have some real successes. So if that isn't encouraging you enough, I don't know what I can do. If that doesn't light your fire, your wood is wet.